She had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" The foreman replied, "She is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from the morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girl. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girl. I told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you've done to your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. "You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servants here." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she'd been working. "The name of the man I work with today is Boaz." "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "The Lord has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers." Then Ruth, the Moabitess, said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girl, because in someone else's fields you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law. One day Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Harry was going to church. He pulled out of his drive in his two-seater sports car. Grateful that he had repaired the leak in the hood, because it had been raining heavily since dawn, and showed no sign of relenting. As he turned the corner into the main road, he saw ahead of him three figures, huddled forlornly under a single umbrella beside the busman. They were all familiar, for they all attended his church. The first was old Mrs. Fosdyke. She was well over 70 and suffered great pain from her rheumatism and arthritis, which were always made worse in wet weather. The second was Dr. Roberts, the local GP. Harry as good as owed this man his life, because a year before he had diagnosed a rare and dangerous illness Harry had contracted from the tropics on holiday, and had treated it successfully for. The third line was Julia. Harry had entertained a burning passion for Julia ever since she'd come to live in the area, though secretly, for as yet he found no opportunity to ask her out. Harry's eye glanced at the solitary passenger seat beside him. He had only a few seconds to make his decision, but it was enough. With an impressive screech of brakes, he drew up beside the bus. Magnanimously, he presented the keys to Dr. Roberts. Attentively, he lowered Mrs. Fosdyke into the passenger seat. Then, with a modest wave, he bid them goodbye, while he huddled close to Julia under the umbrella, praying earnestly that the number 8 bus would be even later than usual. What's the point of my story? Simply this. In matters of romance, meeting the right person almost invariably is the result of a happy collusion between serendipity and silence, between good fortune and good sense, or to use the vocabulary of a Christian theologian, between divine providence and human responsibility. God put Julia by the bus stop. Harry had to work out how to get under the umbrella. It's usually like that. Indeed, this cooperation between God's sovereign control of it and our personal initiative in the handling of those opportunities that God presents us with in his providence. This is the necessary background not just to a successful love life, but to the life of faith generally. And there are a few more charming examples of that interplay between providence and responsibility than the story of Ruth. Indeed, I think it's one of the main things our author's trying to get across to us in these central chapters of the story. If you were here last week, you'll remember that Naomi had returned to Bethlehem in Judah in the wake of this disastrous domestic tragedy. She had lost her husband and both her sons. All she had left was Ruth, her widowed daughter-in-law. Against Naomi's strong advice, Ruth had insisted on coming with her to Judah rather than returning to her own country of Moab. From a human point of view, this was a crazy decision, not least because of its implications for Ruth's marital prospects. Normally, you see, in the ancient world, it fell to the brother of a deceased man to look after his widow. There was even quite a strong moral obligation laid upon such a brother to actually marry the widow and have a child by her who would inherit his deceased brother's share of the family property. Now, we'll have more to say about this ancient and, I suppose, to our ears, rather strange custom, levirate marriage, as it's technically called. We'll have more to say about that next week. But suffice it here to say that Elimelech, Naomi's husband, seems to have had no brothers, no surviving brothers anyway, and all Naomi's own children were dead. This meant there were no close male relatives upon whom the levirate responsibility naturally fell heavily. And as a result, the chances of these two ladies remarrying were pretty slim. In any case, Naomi was already rather old, by the sound of it. And Ruth, of course, was A, foreigner, B, without a dowry, and C, there was a question mark over the fertility of her womb. For in 10 years of marriage, Naomi had received no grandchildren. Always around her, Ruth looked set for a lonely life. It was a bleak outlook, and an insecure one in the violence and the barbarism of that male-dominated world, which was Israel in the 11th century BC, the time of the judgment. And yet, as most of us, I guess, you know, the story of Ruth has a happy ending. Against all the odds, Ruth finds a husband, and Naomi becomes a grandmother. Indeed, more startling even than that, the family line thus begun, in due course, brings forth the royal dynasty of King David. And indeed, Jesus Christ, God's Messiah. So this is a classic rags-to-riches romance, isn't it? It is the story of how Cinderella finds her prince and they live happily ever after. But the thing I want you to notice in these central chapters is the way the inspired narrator quite deliberately draws attention to the way these two concurrent influences we've already mentioned shape Ruth's destiny. Divine providence and human responsibility. God puts Boaz by the bus stop. But Ruth has to work out how to get under the umbrella. And the story we've just read is meant to highlight both those things. Let's pick out first the elements of the divine providence in it all. Boaz himself affirms his faith, his confidence in God's providence where Ruth is concerned, in that benediction he bestows upon her in chapter 2, verse 12. May the Lord repay you for what you have done, he says in verse 12. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. A typical Old Testament picture there, a Jewish picture of the providence of God. God nurturing those who take refuge in him like a mother hen looking after her chicks. Under the protective wings of his care, Ruth had come. And all the way through the story, the narrator has been quietly drawing attention to the all-embracing nature of those wings. If you were here last week, you'll recall perhaps how chapter 1 ends with Naomi's self-pitying complaint about the cruel misfortune that had befallen her. She leaves us in no doubt at all that all this misery was down to God. It was his providence that had brought all this disaster upon her and her daughter-in-law. 4 times she affirms that in verses 20 and 21. Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, she says at the end of chapter 1. The Almighty has made my life bitter. I went away full, the Lord brought me back empty. The Lord afflicted me. The Almighty has brought me fortune upon me. Well, who can blame her for feeling betrayed and disappointed in this way? First the austerity of the famine, then the loss of her husband, then of both her sons. Such a personal history is not calculated to engender feelings of gratitude towards God, is it? And yet, as readers of the story, with the privileged bird's eye view which only the reader of a story has, we know, of course, sir, that if it hadn't been for this tragic chain of events, Ruth, the Moabitess, would never have come to Bethlehem. She would never have found the God of Israel. She'd have never married Boaz. She'd have never have played her special part in the family tree of King David and of Jesus Christ. Naomi's theology, you see, is not at fault. God's providence was supervising the cruel tragedy of her life. But what to her felt like the arbitrary strokes of some sadistic heavenly tyrant, were, if only she'd known this, necessary preparatory moves in a cosmic plan of salvation, so mind-blowing in its full scale and strategy, it almost lay beyond human imagination. It is as Cooper puts it in his famous old hymn, God moves in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform. Judge not the Lord then by feeble senses, but trust him for his grace behind a frowning providence. He hides a smiling face. Indeed, if you think about it, God's providential ways in chapter 1 of this story were even more mysterious than Naomi's grim complaint gives him credit for. For, as we suggested last week, this story of Ruth begins with what I think any informed Jewish reader would have regarded as a lamentable error of judgment on the part of Naomi's husband. Elimelech, we're told, under the economic pressure of famine, chose to emigrate, of all places, to Moab, an enemy nation, an idolatrous nation, a nation about which there were explicit warnings in the law of Moses. It's hard to believe that any pious Jew would have made such a choice. And yet, of course, if he hadn't, the story of Ruth would have never progressed beyond chapter 1, verse 1. It's surely comforting. Some of us torture ourselves with vain regret. If only I hadn't made that mistake. I've forfeited God's purpose for me now. I'm condemned the rest of my life to have only his second best. Rubbish, that. Where in the Bible is God ever reduced to second best? Where in the Bible does God ever have to resort to contingency plans? Where in the Bible do our human mistakes ever obstruct his eternal purpose? Never. On the contrary, the Bible constantly testifies to the way that God, by master strokes of consummate skill, achieves his purposes by means of our human mistakes. What was Judas's betrayal of Jesus if it wasn't a mistake? And without that mistake, Christ would not have saved the world. Don't allow past mistakes to haunt you. Trust rather that God has used them, mistakes though they were. Maybe you did disappoint him, but you didn't surprise him. Maybe you did hurt and offend him, but you did not thwart him. Maybe, as in Naomi's experience, the bud of early life has had a bitter taste. Trust him, the flower will be sweet when it blooms. Behind a frowning poverty, he hides a smiling face. That's the conviction of the Bible, and of the author of Ruth in particular. In fact, our author drops three gentle hints into the narrative of the early part of chapter 2 to sensitize us, his readers, to that underlying divine directing in this whole affair. The first is actually in verse 1, where he tells us Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. Now, why tell us that now? It's out of place in the narrative line. You could argue even that the author has robbed himself of a useful, dramatic sort of device by informing us of Boaz's affiliation to Naomi's dead husband at this early stage. If he'd kept that information back, it would have been a climactic denouement when the identity of Boaz was eventually revealed later on in the chapter. And of course, that failed to recognize his purpose in writing. He is a skilled storyteller, but the dramatic impact is secondary to him, to his theological purpose. He wants us to know about Boaz because he wants us to have insight into this divine providence which is working out in Ruth's experience, even though Ruth herself has no such insight. We need to know who Boaz is so the cogs begin to turn in our mind before they can start to turn in theirs. In verses 2 and 3, you see, he exploits this advantage. Ruth goes out to glean the loose grains of barley that fall in the fields behind the harvesters. The poor were permitted to do this, according to the law of Israel. There was no question of trespass or theft. It was courtesy, it seems, to ask permission before you did it, but Ruth was entitled to do so. Whose field does she just happen to select for her gleaning activity? Why, the field of barley. Now, I say again, she doesn't know this man. She's never seen this man. She has absolutely no idea of his future significance in her life. The Hebrew of verse 3, in fact, draws attention to this most emphatically when it says, as things turned out, you could literally translate it, by pure chance. By pure chance, she found herself working in the field of Boaz. But of course, it wasn't chance. Our author has alerted us to Boaz's identity, and we know it is not chance. We know providence is at work. And as if we confirm our suspicions in this regard, you see, he drops another hint at the beginning of verse 4. Just then, or literally, behold, a Hebrew interjection of surprise and wonder, but behold, Boaz turns up, surprise, surprise again. The man himself. So the romance has begun. Humanly speaking, it's just a fortuitous encounter. Two pairs of eyes meet across a cornfield, one hot summer day. On the one hand, a penniless widow doing her best to retain her dignity and pay the bills, but forced by circumstances to do what, well, let's face it, the ancient equivalent of rifling dust. The other, a handsome hero, undeniably, I think, older than she was, but, as our author puts it, a man of standing in the community, and to judge from his pious greeting to his harvest, a man of faith. Our imaginations are already racing ahead in anticipation of where this meeting is going to lead to. For it's quite clear to us that God's hand is in it. This isn't just chance. And when Ruth gets home and tells her story to Naomi and this about this strange man who has shown such unaccountable favour to her, Naomi is convinced it isn't chance. Verses 19 and 20. Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one whose place she'd been working. The name of the man I work with today is Boaz. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. The Lord has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. This man is our close relative. He's one of our kinsmen redeemed. So for the first time since her bereavement, Naomi's faith seems to have been rekindled. God has given her a son, albeit a cloud no more than the size of a man's hand at this stage, but it is enough to restore her confidence in the trustworthiness of the goodness of God. Sometimes, I suppose, for all of us, under the batterings of providence, cruel providence, our faith ebbs, as my own, so low it needs some kind of evidential sign to reassure us. Like doubting Thomas, our cherished hopes are so brutally crucified, we must see the print of the nails in his body before we will take the emotional risk of believing again. Well, in Thomas's case, and in Naomi's case, God had mercy on such doubts. Perhaps he'll have mercy on our doubts. But that is not to say there is not a better part. Remember what the master said to Thomas? Because you have seen me, have you believed, Thomas? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. And that was Ruth's blessing. She had no sign. She had seen nothing. She knew nothing. Yet her faith had not collapsed. She had forsaken the idolatrous culture of her homeland and entered a solemn covenant with Naomi and her God, in spite of the fact that this God had given her nothing except widowhood. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Pray, noble God. Indeed, she will, Father. God will make sure of that. And in the sovereign providence of God, you'll have a lot more to do with it than you realize right now. Which brings us to the second aspect of our theme this morning. The divine providence of God on the one hand, human responsibility on the other. Look at chapter 3, verse 9. Who are you? Boaz asked. I am your servant Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer. Quite a number of the more recent articles and commentaries on Ruth draw attention to the relevance of her story for the whole feminism debate. And it's not difficult to see why. This is one audacious lady. She doesn't need a man to tell her what to do. Indeed, contrary to all the cultural expectations of ancient patriarchal society, she comes pretty close here to telling Boaz what to do, doesn't she? No shrinking veil of this, who is content to simple in the background, in the expectation that God is going to drop his blessings in her lap. No, insofar as she can, by her own enterprise and energy, work for the fulfillment of his purpose in her life, she does so. She balances her commitment, her patient trust in God's providence with an active demonstration of her own responsible freedom. We saw the first sign of this individual strength of character in Ruth, of course, last week in her heroic commitment to Naomi. I think we see it again, don't we, in her diligent application to the task of gleaning. Naomi, a mother-in-law, was either too demoralized by her grief or maybe humiliated by her reduced circumstances to go gathering corn herself like a pauper. But Ruth suffers no such paralysis. She was not a woman to sit at home wallowing in self-pity or wounded pride. She had trusted God for her future. She didn't know what it was. But while she waited for further light on that score, she was determined to go and make a living for herself and her mother-in-law. So she did. That's the sort of woman she was. And of course, this is the point, the very point the author surely wants us to get. It's in the very process of her doing that that God brings to her attention the husband he has in his providence provided for. God's favor throughout this story is experienced by men and women as they act in faith. Nobody is blessed in the story of Ruth by doing nothing. As we said at first, Ruth has no more idea of what's to come than Boaz does. She is perhaps just a little flattered or mystified by the interest this older and wealthier man has shown in her. Not that there's anything flirtatious about his behavior. On the contrary, he's anxious to prevent sexual harassment from his own workers. His attitude throughout is that of a benefactor rather than a would-be lover. Some speculate that maybe he was a widower himself. We don't know that for sure. Certainly, judging from a comment he makes in chapter 3, verse 10, he seems to have felt that he was rather past marriageable age. There were too many good-looking young men around for him to court the bride without risking indignity or inviting mockery, perhaps, and a person of his standing in the community couldn't afford to take that risk. He certainly seems to have entertained no serious anticipation of any romantic liaison between himself and this Moabite woman. But he is attracted to her. And Ruth senses that. He's attracted to her not just physically, I'm sure there was an element of that. It's her character that impresses him most. Her hard work in the field. Her sacrificial commitment to Naomi. And most of all, her faith in the God of Israel. A faith all the more obvious in its genuineness because she was a foreigner. May the Lord bless you. May you be richly rewarded. Under his wings you have come to take refuge. It's not hard to imagine the brightening of Ruth's eyes as he speaks words like that. A man of this quality and nobility, has noticed her. He treated her with respect, not just as a bit of all right to laugh about with his male friends, like no doubt the rest of the harvesters were inclined to do. Who could blame her for finding such attention? Ignites the flame of romance in her heart for the Lord. As we saw last week, she understood the nature of love, covenant love. Love that believes in commitment and sacrifice. She knew that was the kind of love God himself demonstrated to his people and expected from his people. And here I suspect she sensed she had met a man who shared her appreciation of and understanding of that covenant. What's more, wise old Naomi agreed. "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you'll be well provided for? Is not Boaz, to whose servant girls you have been a kinsman of ours?" Up to this moment, you see, faith has been working passively. Ruth has been responding to the divine providence that has brought Boaz into contact with her life. But now an active step of faith is involved. A God-given opportunity must not be missed. Boaz has no idea Ruth even considers him an eligible prospect. She has to tell him. But that is far from easy, given the constraints of sexual protocol in the ancient Oriental world. She had to find the right place and time. And Naomi, who understood the culture, and who had plenty of experience, her wise counsel would guide her. I suspect the narrator has his tongue rather than his cheek as he recounts this little conspiracy of feminine wiles at the beginning of chapter 3. "If I were you, dear, a splash of Chanel number 5 wouldn't go amiss." "And how about that nice little black number? You look so nice." "Then, of course, you have to choose the right moment, my dear." "Well, nighttime is always more romantic than the day, you know? And you need to catch him in a nice, relaxed mood." "After the bar happens. You know they always have a party. Drink a little bit too much wine, perhaps. That's a good moment." There is considerable debate among the commentators about the precise significance of this uncovering of the feast. The more modest suggest the purpose is simply to wake Boaz gently when he feels his toes getting cold. It has to be said there is a more adventurous interpretation of that. This word feet was sometimes used in the Hebrew as a euphemism for the genitals. And some commentators believe it bears that force here. All one can say, I think, for certain, is at the very least, this action Ruth was taking was decidedly risque. Decidedly risque. She was gambling with her dignity and with her chastity. If he chose to take sexual advantage of the situation, Ruth would have no defense against Boaz. What on earth was she doing, uncovering a man's body at this time of night? And everybody knew what sort of hanky-panky people got up to after the harvest Thanksgiving party. Had she read the nobility of this man's character right? Could she trust his sexual propriety as she thought he did? Would he misread her motives? Would he jump to the conclusion she was just a loose woman come to seduce? It was a huge risk. But surely our author is trying to tell us here that sometimes life demands such risk. It's not enough just to wait on God's providence all the time. Sometimes we do have to take responsibility for our own destiny. Sometimes we do have to exercise our God-given power of self-determination. Sometimes a courageous and enterprising, an opportunistic even, initiative is demanded of us, or else we're going to forfeit the blessing which God is only too willing to bestow on us. Ruth, this woman of character, displays precisely such initiative. You notice Naomi, her mother, had advised her to keep her mouth shut and let Boaz do all the talking. But Ruth is far too irrepressible and excited to exercise such reticence. "Who are you?" he asks. "I'm your servant Ruth," she says, and then blurts out, "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." "That's what I'm here for, Boaz, you better know it straight away." Now, this is a case where it really does help to know a little Hebrew, because that phrase, spread the corner of your garment over me, is deliciously ambiguous. See, on the one hand, it's regularly used in Semitic culture as a euphemism for marriage. Even to the present day, you'll find other occurrences in the Bible that have been used that way. When a man spreads the corner of his skirt or his garment over a woman, that's saying he's married. The symbolism is obvious. But on the other hand, you see, the Hebrew word for garment or skirt is actually the very same plural word that was translated back in chapter 2, verse 12, as wings. Under whose wings you have come for refuge. Spread your wings over me. I've got no doubt that there's a deliberate echo of those earlier words of Boaz there. You see what Ruth is saying here, in effect. You prayed for my blessing, Boaz. You prayed for my blessing since I have sought the protective wings of Jehovah. Well now, Boaz, let's face it. You're my dead husband's kinsman, one of the few he's got. Doesn't it fall to you, then, to do more than pray for me in this situation? Isn't it your responsibility under God's covenant law to redeem me from this helpless and hopeless condition of my widowhood? Don't you see, Boaz, as far as I'm concerned, the protective wings of Jehovah are your wings. His skirt is your skirt. You are the answer to your own prayer. Spread your wings. Your skirt over me. Marry me. And as we shall see next week, Prince Charming does. What do we learn then from this story of Ruth in these central chapters? I say again, we learn that faith in the Bible is both passive and active. It's passive in the sense that faith must sometimes be content to wait for God to act. Be still before the Lord. Wait patiently for him, says the psalm. Because it is the Lord who ultimately organizes the circumstances of our lives. He works out everything, says the apostle, in conformity with the purpose of his own will. And faith means trusting that divine purpose. Trusting that it's a loving purpose. A purpose that can be relied upon to work all things together for good. We see that faith in Ruth as she accepts her tragic and bereaved situation with good grace, refusing, perhaps unlike Naomi, to let resentment fester in her heart. Faith in this respect is the opposite, you see, of fretful anxiety. Faith is patience. Faith is contentment with our lot. Faith is even resignation. But that does not mean that faith is complacency, or idleness, or negligence. There's all the difference in the world between trusting in God and twiddling your thumbs. Because faith also sometimes demands action, endeavor, enterprise. By faith, Abraham left his home, even though he did not know where he was going, says the author of Hebrews. And in doing so, Abraham became a paradigm of that spirit of adventure which characterizes real faith throughout the Bible. Faith sometimes requires us to take risks. Calculated risks, it's true. The believer isn't a daredevil who frivolously hazards his or her life in wanton recklessness. No, faith assesses the risks. Its audacity is measured and thought. But to the unbeliever, it may sometimes seem as though it is playing Russian roulette with faith, nevertheless. For faith's calculations are based on an invisible reality. Faith is being sure of what we hope for, certain of what we don't see, says the writer of the Hebrews again. And for that reason, to unbelieving eyes, a step of faith will often be indistinguishable from a step of folly. Ruth's audacious words to Boaz are a classic case. What Jewish male would fail to be offended by such a reversal of roles? It's the man who does the proposing, not the woman, Ruth. You should know that. But such a convention would have left the two of them forever in the tragic irony of unfulfilled happiness. Ruth had to take the initiative in this relationship. Boaz was far too self-deprecating to consider himself a possible husband for this young woman. And I say again, Ruth has the character, the faith, to step out boldly and take that initiative. She shows us how to blend passive waiting on God with active expecting from God. How to temper the patience of faith with the gamble of faith. They're both there in Ruth. Beautifully illustrated. Do you know that that anonymous prayer, you sometimes see it on office walls. Give me, good Lord, the grace to perform with diligence those things I can do, to accept with humility those things I cannot do, and the wisdom to distinguish between the two. Good prayer. People become unbalanced so often in their lives because they lack that wisdom. On the one hand, some become apathetic fatalists. They are convinced that nothing they do can possibly make any difference to the way things turn out. Like Omar Khayyam, they resign themselves to fate. Life is but a checkerboard of nights and days where destiny with men for pieces plays. On the other hand, of course, some become sanguine egoists who are confident they can and must make things happen for themselves. So like W.E. Henley, they boast, in the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Well, the path of faith lies in neither of those extremes. They are both godless extremes. Faith understands and reckons both on the divine providence and on human responsibility. Behind the sometimes paradoxical interaction of these fundamental truths of our existence lies, you see, God's desire to make a world in which his undeniable sovereignty is nevertheless expressed through our meaningful freedom. That's how he wants the world to be. That's how he determined the world to be. Contrary to Omar Khayyam, we are not disposable pawns on his chessboard or puppets manipulated by his hidden strings. We are responsible agents, able to make real decisions, real choices. Yet, contrary to Henry, we are not the master of our fate. For God is in charge. Our liberty is constrained within the circle of his divine permission and oversight. Only a God who is as all-knowing and as all-powerful as he is could do the trick of welding these things together. It's not surprising we are sometimes bewildered at how our human responsibility and his sovereign providence can both be true. How it is that one doesn't have to be sacrificed on the altar of the other. But the Bible insists it is not so. He chooses to work his sovereign will out by means of our free decisions. That's how he does it. That's what Christian existence, living by faith, is all about. And again, we see it. Think about prayer. How does it work? God knows what he's going to do. He reads the future with infallible precision. Surely prayer isn't important. It's suggesting we know what should happen better than he does. And anyway, he's already decided what's going to happen, so what's the point in it anyway? How does prayer work? It works because he chooses to achieve his will through our prayers. That's why it works. He has built our prayers into his plan. We are not passive, ignorant pawns. We are active, intelligent collaborators with the divine purpose. That's what he wants us to be. He involves us in his eternal purposes. And prayer is one of the ways he achieves that goal. Our freedom lies within the orbit. They're not at all. Our prayers are the means through which his will is energized in the world. They're not redundant pipes. Or think about our Christian growth in holiness. How does that happen? The Bible says God is determined to conform us to the likeness of his Son. There is not one of us that is going to get to heaven if we are believers and not have been fully sanctified by his grace to be like Jesus. And yet the Bible tells us that process of moral change does not take place except by our voluntary decision to live in a way that pleases God. God is not some cosmic rapist. He waits upon our willingness. And so the Bible says, work out your own salvation, for God is at work in you to will and do his good pleasure. It's the same thing. Think about a business as simple and as ordinary as daily bread. Do you recall these words of Jesus? Do not worry about your life, what you shall eat. Look at the birds of the air. God feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than them? In other words, says Jesus, trust the loving providence of God to meet your material needs. But does then that mean that we are to sit with our hands folded and wait for God to put the food in our mouth? Of course that isn't what Jesus means. If some super spiritual little bird of the air were to take the line that he was not going to look for worms this morning, he was going to sit in his nest and trust the Lord, that super spiritual little bird would quickly starve. For God appoints the means. He expects us to use the means he has provided through our personal responsibility. He has endowed us with abilities and freedom. Think about it. Decision making. Some of us here, perhaps, like Ruth, would like to find a marital partner. Some of us, perhaps, would like to find a job. There are all sorts of issues of guidance, aren't there, that arise in our Christian life. Learn from Ruth then. First, how to be patient. Wait for God in his providence to put the right person, the right job, the right opportunity by the doctor. Don't fret during that waiting period. Learn in patience to wait for God. But learn also from Ruth how to be decisive. How to get under the umbrella when the opportunity presents itself. Some of us miss the happiness maybe God would have us enjoy. Because we think we're being pious when we're really being lazy or cowardly. In fact, you know, what this all comes down to at the end of the day is this. Think like Jesus. You remember the cross, I'm sure. A cross where the Bible tells us Christ died for the sin of the world. We are told that cross was planned in the eternal counsels of God before the world was made. And yet what, strangely, do we see the night before in Gethsemane? We see a man struggling, wrestling in prayer. Not my will. Yours be done. So was the will of God in doubt? Was Jesus just a pawn in the divine purpose then? Certainly not. God had so woven the rich tapestry of his purpose together that in that narrow window of time, eternity was contingent upon history. The fate of the universe is different because at that moment, a man, a free man, chose to grasp the wood of the cross. Not my will, but yours be done, he said. This was not play acting. This was a real, responsible choice. Who can doubt it? He went to the cross, a voluntary sacrifice. Not as a pawn on some cosmic chess. He made God's purpose his choice. He prayed that God's will would be done in his life. He used his responsible freedom to see the will of God done. And that is ultimately what the life of faith is about. There, above all moments in this world's history, we see how divine providence and human responsibility intersect. There we see how this jigsaw of human destiny is resolved between a sovereign God and free human beings made in His image. So don't be paralyzed by morbid fatalism, but don't be driven either by anxious self-reliance. Use the means God has given you. Use the opportunities God has given you. Use the gifts God has given you. Use them imaginatively, courageously, responsibly. Live like we. Live like Jesus Christ. Patiently depending on God's providential care under the protective wings of the Almighty. But never using that protection as an excuse for apathy or laziness or negligence or complacency or cowardice. Live by faith, a life of patience and godly